Welcome. Today is Wednesday, October 18th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, a major development in the fight against terrorism in the Middle East.
ISIS holds no major urban center anymore in either Iraq or Syria.
The opioid crisis tracked all the way to China. Another big Hollywood celebrity opens up about sexual abuse.
Being sexually assaulted at the age of 16 by a director.
Also ahead, an astronomical discovery in space. It's all on today's International Edition. A U.S. military spokesman says Syrian Democratic Forces, backed by U.S.-led coalition forces, have all but driven Islamic State militants from the last remaining areas of Raqqa, Syria. The offensive to oust the militants from Raqqa began in June and was backed by airstrikes and other support from a U.S.-led coalition. Joshua Landis is director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma, and he speaks with International Edition's Sarah Williams about the significance of this ouster.
Well, it's big. This is the capital of ISIS in Syria. It's the counterpart to Mosul in Iraq. Today, ISIS holds no major urban center anymore in either Iraq or Syria. There are small towns scattered about in the desert where they can find refuge, but those towns are going to be taken quickly. This is the raggedy ending now for ISIS as a territorial state. It's going to have to reinvent itself in some very different way. But it's a major blow, and this is a big accomplishment for the U.S. effort to destroy ISIS.
However, Islamic State still controls areas around the eastern province of Deir el-Zor and, I believe, further south in the Euphrates River Valley.
That's true. There are a lot of towns dotted along the Euphrates River Valley. In Deir el-Zor, the Syrian army has been moving up pretty rapidly, and the Syrian Democratic Forces that are backed by the United States are also coming in from the north. There isn't a really deep urban defense line in Deir ez-Zor the way there was in Raqqa or Mosul. And the leadership of ISIS is now, according to U.S. leadership there at the coalition, is cut off from the people who are manning these stations. So there is not entirely chaos amongst the ISIS members, but they're not what they used to be. We saw over 1,000 ISIS members give up and come out and make a deal in Iraq recently. A few hundred more left Raqqa under a negotiated truce. This is something we hadn't been seeing before. I think that many of the ISIS members are going to try to save themselves at this point. They're not going to make a last stand. Some of the foreign fighters will, because they can't drift off. They can't sneak into the general population and try to go deep and silent. But by and large, they're scattered, chaotic, and on the run.
Well, if this marks the end of Islamic State as a territorial controller, however, there are a number of ISIS members scattered around, including many in Europe and probably here in the United States as well.
That's true. And there are enclaves in Libya, in Egypt, and elsewhere where ISIS has dug in places like Yemen and in Africa. So they are still hopeful that they can carve out areas of control in territories which don't have central government, which are weak. And that's probably where they're going to concentrate, at least to build up training grounds and central command. But you're right, there will be individuals who work in the West and will try to make spectacular attacks. We've seen them do this in the past. But Raqqa was one of the main places where there was a centrally organized effort to train and equip fighters to go into Europe. Many of the fighters, who attacked in Belgium and France, had a connection to the leadership in Raqqa. So destroying Raqqa is going to make it much harder for ISIS to launch fighters in Europe or the United States.
And then, of course, there's the civilian population of Raqqa, which has suffered tremendously as Islamic State controlled the city.
They have, and they've suffered tremendously with the bombardment, of course, the liberation of Raqqa, as we saw with Mosul or Aleppo or other major cities. The urban warfare has been furious, and ISIS has been willing to sacrifice themselves, take civilian hostages, hunker down, and fight to the end. And this has, of course, caused the near total destruction of many of these cities. And that's going to be many, many years trying to rebuild and reconstruct these areas. And in the case of Raqqa, it's not clear who's going to reconstruct it, because the United States, in theory, is the major power that controls that region of Iraq. It's then under Kurdish control, but there are local Arab allies that are theoretically going to have a city council, control over a city council. But who's going to give them money? How are they going to rebuild? It's not clear at all.
That's Joshua Landis, director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. President Trump praises Greece as the most stable country in the region. Doubts are growing that the U.S. will always defend its Asian allies. Canada says NAFTA's proposed changes from the U.S. are troubling. And firefighters are shifting into recovery phase in Northern California. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com. And on our VOA mobile app, this is International Edition. Well, U.S. law enforcement officials announced Tuesday the indictments of two Chinese nationals and their North American associates charged with manufacturing and distributing fentanyl and other opioids into the U.S. U.S. Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein said the charges represent the first ever indictments brought against designated Chinese manufacturers of fentanyl and other opiate substances.
Today, we are pleased to announce two indictments that mark a major milestone in our battle to stop deadly fentanyl from entering the United States. For the first time, we have indicted major Chinese fentanyl traffickers who've been using the internet to transport fentanyl and fentanyl analogs to drug traffickers and to individual customers in the United States. These cases reflect a new and disturbing trend.
Rosenstein said he was very concerned by the revelation, first reported by CBS's 60 Minutes and The Washington Post, but he said, if you look at the data, what you see is that the increase in drug overdose deaths is usually or actually driven by the Chinese fentanyl rather than the pharmaceutical drugs. U.S. Drug Enforcement Agency spokesman Rusty Payne said the number of fatalities from these drugs in the United States is beyond belief, and China is a big contributor.
We're talking about an NFL stadium or a Major League Baseball stadium filled to the rim with dead people. In 1 year, in 50 states, there's a lot of it we can attribute to drugs that come from overseas, specifically from these rogue underground labs in China.
Fentanyl, a painkiller that's 100 times stronger than morphine. China is the main source of illicit fentanyl sold in the United States, according to a recent report. In addition to shipping directly to U.S. customers, Chinese manufacturers, which are weakly regulated, deliver shipments of the drug to Mexico and Canada, from which it's often trafficked into the United States. Well, on a happier note, a wondrous discovery may explain how gold, platinum, uranium, and uranium were created. A big announcement this week from the international science community. Joining us to tell us all about it is NASA Jet Propulsion Lab Ambassador Greg Redfern. Greg, what's this all about?
Laurie, it was a big deal because for the first time, the astronomical community had detected the merger of two dead stars we call neutron stars that had merged together, and after their merger released a huge explosion that was visible in optical light. So the first time in the history of astronomy you had what we call gravitational waves, which we can explain, followed up by observations in optical light of the same event, which was a spectacular merger of two dead stars, resulting in what astronomers call, are you ready for, a kilonova.
What's that?
A kilonova, we now know, is when two neutron stars merge. And let's help our listeners. A neutron star is a dead star. It's not producing energy, but it's very, very massive. It has the entire mass of our sun compacted into a star that's only maybe 20 miles across. They are the most solid objects in the universe. They're made of pure neutrons. Lori, if I took a teaspoon of neutron star matter, it would weigh over a billion tons. So when these two neutron stars spiral together in a galaxy 130 million light years away, when they merged, they shook the very fabric of space-time and emitted these gravitational waves predicted by Einstein over 100 years ago, and it intercepted, those gravitational waves intercepted our planet on August 17, 2017 at 8:41 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time in the three gravitational wave observatories located in Hanford, Washington, down in Louisiana, and over in Italy, which is called Virgo, intercepted this shaking of space-time. Alarms went off, and 2 seconds later, NASA's Fermi Space Telescope detected these high-energy light waves called gamma rays, sent off alarms, and the rush was on to find where this happened. And they were subsequently successful, took pictures of it, had been following it, and even now, Lori, we continue to see the remnant of this kilonova, this neutron star merger, now in radio waves using our radio telescopes. Spectacular finding.
So what does this mean now, going forward?
Well, there's a couple things. Number one, if any of your listeners own anything made out of gold, be it a gold watch, gold in your crown and your teeth, gold in a wedding band, gold in jewelry, we now know that the merger of neutron stars creates gold, creates platinum, creates uranium. Astronomers were able to determine that when these two neutron stars collided and exploded and were 200 million times brighter than our own sun, the energy was sufficient to produce 16,000 times the mass of our planet in all heavy elements beyond iron and nickel. And it also produced tens of times the whole Earth's mass in gold, platinum, uranium. And this is all spreading out in the host galaxy where this happened, NGC 4993. And as a result, over the eons to come, all this material will become new planets, support new life, an amazing story of creation.
All right. Well, we appreciate your filling us in. Fascinating stuff. Greg Redfern, NASA Jet Propulsion Lab Ambassador, thank you so much. And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Music time in Africa. Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Friday at 0900 and Saturday and Sunday at 0900, 15, 20, and 2200 hours UTC.
Hi, this is Victor Beatty, Managing Editor of VOA News. Tune in to the Voice of America's newscasts every hour on the top of each hour, 24/7. Listen to our news and correspondent reports from around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information.
VOA. VOA's International Edition continues now with what's trending on social media. And for that, we're joined by VOA's Andrew Palchewski. Hey, Andrew, what's happening?
Well, Lori, we have two examples of how social media can be used for the wrong reasons and can kind of snowball out of control. And then we have one example of how it's used for the right reasons.
Okay.
So how it's used in the wrong way. A company that was advertising online a bunch of Halloween costumes put up a costume that got a lot of attention and a lot of criticism on social media because it was a costume of Anne Frank, of course, the hero during the Holocaust who cataloged her experiences hiding from the Nazis in the Diary of Anne Frank.
Yes.
Lots of people on social media took this company to task, saying this was very poor taste. The company came out and said that they offer costumes for historical reenactments and for plays,
mm-hmm.
that this wasn't necessarily intended for Halloween, but they have removed that costume from
yeah.
their website. But
yeah.
a lot of attention, negative attention on that on social media.
Interesting. Now, yeah, I would say that would be a little touchy.
Yes.
Touchy subject.
It is.
For
and
sure.
now that instance over the Halloween costume and the outrage over that prompted the Scaramucci Post to put up a poll on social media. Now, if that name sounds familiar, it's because the Scaramucci Post is a media outpost run by Anthony Scaramucci, the former...
The Mooch.
The former, very briefly tenured White House communications director in the Trump
right,
administration.
That was like, what, he was about a week that he worked there? Did that?
Something like
okay.
that. Less, right. less than a month, let's
okay.
say. But the poll that they put up on Twitter asked how many Jews died in the Holocaust and had different responses that you could put in. Now, Anthony Scaramucci put out a statement on Twitter saying that he was out of the country. He did not authorize this. And the reason why this poll was put up was because their social media person wanted to try to capitalize on the attention of this Anne Frank dust up over the costume and promote Holocaust awareness as a result
okay.
of that offensive Anne Frank costume. However, this
didn't go over too well.
Did not go over too well.
Mm.
They have taken the poll down. They said that the people are going to be fired. And Anthony Scaramucci
oh, wow.
has spoken out about this on
okay.
social media.
Well,
but some instances
That's
where
good.
Social media have not been used in great ways.
No
However,
kidding.
There is one big instance where social media has been used in a very positive way to draw attention to the issue of sexual harassment and sexual
abuse. Who hasn't seen that stuff?
Who hasn't seen hashtag Me Too, started
yes.
over the weekend
yes.
by actress Alyssa Milano. She said, if every woman who has been harassed or assaulted posts Me Too on social media, we will see how pervasive this problem is. And I can't tell you how many people I have seen, mostly women, but men as well,
right.
who have posted Me Too on social media. Many of them are not just posting Me Too or hashtag Me Too. They're putting that up and then offering instances of how they were assaulted or
right,
how they were harassed
right.
and drawing attention to their specific instances.
Yeah.
Now, this hashtag Me Too has evolved. It's not just about people saying that they were assaulted or harassed. It's about the ones who have assaulted or harassed them taking ownership of it. So there's also been now hashtag I did this or hashtag
wow.
him though. And men are actually stepping forward. I've
That's
seen
very
some
cool.
posts where men have said, I probably strayed into territory that was inappropriate. I apologize for my actions. So it's not just putting the onus on the people who have been attacked or abused or assaulted. It's putting it on the people who have done those actions. So through this one hashtag and this one campaign, we're seeing this all exposed in the light of the Harvey Weinstein case
yeah.
and the dozens of women who have come forward there and many other sexual assault and harassment cases. People
yeah.
are taking their social media accounts and using that to speak out.
Yeah, and it's quite compelling when you see how many people are saying Me Too, Me Too, Me Too, like women in general especially.
It is.
And men too. But and it's just coincidentally Domestic Violence Awareness Month.
Yeah, so it's all the more reason to speak out against this and all the more reason to bring all the parties into the conversation, including the people who are doing the abuse. They're taking a step up and saying, I've done this, I'm sorry that I did this, and they're taking ownership of that.
Absolutely fantastic. All right, awesome. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, Andrew, you can follow him on Twitter at APAL. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. And now we're joined by Rare.us content editor Nicole Michelle. Hi, Nicole. We've been talking about this viral hashtag Me Too following the Harvey Weinstein revelations of sexual assault and harassment. And now another celebrity is coming out talking about a tragic situation that happened to her. Tell us a little bit about what you've heard.
Yeah, Reese Witherspoon talked about being sexually assaulted at the age of 16 by a director of a film. She opened up about her experience at the L Women in Hollywood event in Los Angeles Angeles on Monday, and she said, quote, "I feel true disgust at the director who assaulted me when I was 16. And then she went on to tell the crowd that she was encouraged by her agents and other producers to not talk about it and to hide it. So now, all these years later, she's coming forward, just like Angelina Jolie came forward against Harvey Weinstein, and Gwyneth Paltrow came forward, and Rose McGowan, and the list goes on and on. So something else that really, I think, resonated with a lot of people from what Reese said yesterday is that women are now going to talk about, and men too, and they're not going to take this abuse. And she's really hoping that the voice changes and that people are more open to talking about this and really making sure that this doesn't happen to others.
Yeah, this thing has really exploded into something that could bring about positive change because people are finally feeling like they're safe enough to speak out. And I think, you know, you do have to credit celebrities for speaking out because it gives the rest of us courage to know that it's okay.
Definitely.
And then we've got another story about a musician, a huge musician that's a little under the weather and not able to perform. What's going on?
Yeah, Ed Sheeran had a little bit of an accident. He was on a bicycle and I guess crashed. So he posted on Instagram, he posted a photo of both of his arms. One was very bandaged up and the other one was in a sling. And he wrote that he may have to be canceling some of his upcoming concert dates. Right now he's doing a tour in Asia. And just before we got on air, I found out that he actually did cancel 5 tour dates in Asia. He was supposed to be in Hong Kong and Taiwan and somewhere in Japan as well. So hopefully he's getting the medical care that he needs. And actually in the post on Instagram, whoever wrote it for him said this isn't even Ed typing. His hands are so severely damaged right now that he just has to take a break. So he's definitely not going to be playing the guitar anytime soon. But maybe after the next couple of weeks, he'll be back on those tour dates.
Oh, what a shame of all things for a musician to not be able to use his hands to play a guitar. Wow.
Poor guy.
I know. And so we're still on Royal Baby Watch, too.
Yes, we have an update. Duchess Catherine made her first public appearance last week with her little tiny baby bump on display. She made an appearance with her husband in honor of World Mental Health Day, which is something that's very near and dear to her heart and Prince William's heart. And then just today they announced that the baby is due April 2018. They announced that on Twitter, writing, "The Duke and Duchess of Cambridge are delighted to confirm they are expecting the baby in April 2018. So we are all officially on baby watch now, and I can't get enough of those first photos of the Duchess when she's just starting to show. We're all going to enjoy seeing her maternity fashion choices and then also the arrival of the baby in April.
All right, for sure. Rare.us content editor Nicole Moschella, thanks so much for being with us as always. Well, after sitting 50 years in the National Geographic Archives, 100 hours of footage on Jane Goodall and her groundbreaking observations of chimpanzees in the African forest of Tanzania have been compiled into a documentary film. At a screening of the film in Los Angeles, Goodall spoke to VOA's Elizabeth Lee about her work and thoughts on the film.
Day after day, in the sun and the wind and the rain.
The documentary titled Jane starts in 1960, when Jane Goodall was 26 years old. Through interviews with Goodall and National Geographic footage, the film documents Goodall's early years as a woman with no university degree, working in a remote part of Tanzania. Her unconventional ways of observing these chimps challenged the scientific community's belief on what it means to be human.
Well, more than any other documentary that's been made, it does take me back into the actual feeling I had when I was out there in the forest. And so it's very moving.
Goodall says the music composed by Philip Glass made watching the documentary a magical experience for her. For Glass, there was one moment in the film that especially moved him.
The very intimate scenes when she's sitting with them, and they're like children to her. She's combing their hair and she talks with them, and they're just with her as if they've accepted her totally.
With that acceptance, Goodall made headlines by discovering that chimpanzees are intelligent, social animals who used tools to gather food, something the scientific community at the time believed only humans could do.
Everything worked out perfectly, and were mistakes made, of course, but one learns from mistakes. And so I wouldn't have changed anything, really.
Goodall remembers her unique relationship with the chimps.
It's not quite family, but it's not quite like friends, but it, you know, I'm part of their lives. They accept me. I can watch what they do. And, of course, in the time of the movie, we had a really close, touching relationship, which we don't have anymore.
This documentary features the footage of National Geographic filmmaker Hugo van Lawick, Goodall's first husband.
Going through 100 hours of Hugo van Lawick's footage is a dream. Hugo's one of the greatest wildlife cinematographers in the history of filmmaking.
Hollywood actor Jamie Lee Curtis describes why she is in awe of Goodall.
She has just by doing what she loves, has brought us all along on the journey. And that's a message, if anything. You know, be uncompromising in your vision, uncompromising in your attack and attitude of what it is that you do.
I was persuaded.
Even in present day, Goodall continues to travel and speak about the need to protect the natural world. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Los Angeles.
All right. Well, that's going to do it for today's show. I'm a big fan of Jane Goodall, always have been. Thank you for listening to International Edition, but you can find us any time of the day at voanews.com. And thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Zainab Abdul-Rahman. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
It's been 11 years since renowned Russian journalist Anna Politkovskaya was shot and killed in the elevator of her apartment building in Moscow after she exposed human rights abuses in Chechnya and corruption in the Kremlin. In June 2014, sentences were handed down to five individuals for her murder, but the mastermind who ordered her killing remains unknown, more than a decade after her death. On the most recent anniversary of her murder, U.S. State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert called on Russian authorities to identify and prosecute the person or persons who ordered, planned, and funded this terrible crime. According to the latest State Department annual report on human rights, in 2016, no progress was reported in establishing accountability for Ms. Politkovskaya's death or for the killing of other high-profile journalists, such as Paul Klebnikov in Moscow in 2004 or Natalia Estemirova in Chechnya in 2009. The State Department report noted that journalists in Russia continued to be subjected to arrest, imprisonment, physical attack, harassment, and intimidation as a result of their work. Journalists reporting in or on the North Caucasus remain particularly vulnerable to physical attacks for their reporting, the State Department said. In her statement on the anniversary of Anna Politkovskaya's death, spokesperson Nauert wrote that Ms. Politkovskaya's reporting brought to light the violation of human rights in Russia and the suffering of victims of the war in the North Caucasus region. She noted that recent reports of abuses against LGBTI persons and extrajudicial killings in Chechnya leave us deeply concerned that human rights violations are still regularly committed with impunity in this region. The unsolved murders of Ms. Politkovskaya, a dual U.S.-Russia citizen, and other journalists in Russia, as well as threats against journalists exposing more recent abuses in Chechnya, Ms. Nauert said, have only worsened an atmosphere of intimidation for the independent press. From its founding, the United States has recognized that a free and independent press is indispensable to democratic governance and the rule of law. The Russian people deserve that their government recognize free expression as a fundamental human right that must be protected, not flouted or crushed.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.